You do not need an Apple Watch for your wedding day. Put it down. You've made your decision. You do not need to track your heart rate because you're not running anywhere.
There's a new movement called quantified self, and I think it's bullshit. People are wearing multiple wearables and they're tracking nearly everything about themselves. It stems from this theory that somehow knowledge is power.
I will fill out as my Whoop journal, and then I'll check my Oura Ring data. How does that correlate with the Whoop and the Apple Watch sleep data? Then I check HRV for training, then my sleep data, and then finally my Garmin data. And then lastly, natural cycles. And finally, Strava.
That knowing more about our bodies and the health consequences of our actions will somehow lead to better behaviors. Sounds legit, right? In fact, psychologists have come up with 93 methods for positively changing our behavior. They call this the BCTT, Behavioral Change Technique Taxonomy. And wearables hit a lot of these points. They help with setting goals, monitoring our progress, gamification and social rewards, as well as signaling. When we have one of these wearables on, we're making a statement to the world. We're telling everyone, hey, I'm serious about my health. I'm a top 1% performer. I'm basically the Michael Jordan of getting 10,000 steps a day. But here's the thing. I think measuring all of these things and getting monthly blood tests, it's cool. It's interesting. But I don't think it works for real people. I think there are a subset of super responders, people who it benefits tremendously, but I don't think they work on real people. People like me, who are out of shape, we're lazy, we're unhealthy, but it's not because we don't have the information. It's for a whole host of other reasons that I don't think wearables actually help with. I argued about this with Nathan Dibb, the founder of Vital, a startup that's gone through Y Combinator, basically the Harvard of startups, and has raised $2.9 million from the likes of Point9 and Harry Stebbing's 20 VC fund. His startup is quite cool. He's building an infrastructure layer for all of this wearable and lab data. Loads of other startups and big companies want to integrate wearable and lab data from things like the Apple Watch or Whoop or the Oura Ring, but it's really hard and it takes a lot of time and development. Vital basically makes that possible for them overnight. It's quite similar to Stripe in the payments processing world. I started off by calling his whole industry bullshit.
Let me give you a controversial view of mine related to your industry. This whole thesis around lots of health data being super, super useful, especially in younger, mostly healthy populations. So using it as like almost like preventative or screening, or I would say just tracking data for the sake of it, and that will give you some big unlock. I think it's complete BS. I think that any conclusion that you would draw from all of these wearables or a lot of these even lab panels that you would do as someone who doesn't have like an acute medical need, you're just kind of interested. So that ranges from like CGM to heart rate variability to VO2 max to even basic blood panels. I just don't think it's that useful, because I think the, you know, if we go down the like Bayesian decision tree, the end result is always going to be don't eat crap, like drink less alcohol, don't smoke, exercise more. So I view a lot of the activity in this space as like, I don't want to say grifters, but I view it as like, I just don't think it's actually benefiting anyone. I think it's cool, but I don't think it benefits people. What do you think?
I think there's nuance, is what I'll say. So I guess, what are the three most important like lifestyle changes I think you can make? It's exercise. I think there's a study that was released recently that showed like exercise is the most important thing, right? And we kind of understand. Well, I think everyone's agreeing exercise is so important to human health, right? So exercise, I think nutrition and sleep, right? They're probably the three biggest or like the most important factors, right? Would you agree, I guess?
Yeah, I would completely agree with that.
So the question is like, can wearables help us adjust that behavior? And I think the answer to me is yes, because I've seen it firsthand. Can we get people to exercise more using wearables and then building software that incentivizes people to exercise more? I think yes. I think one of the, you know, I wear an Apple Watch. One of the coolest things about Apple Watch, it's so basic, but it works, is the ring mechanism, right? Closing your rings at the end of the day. For me, like, that incentivizes me to go and make sure I get 10,000 steps a day. You know, I'm often like just sitting on the computer all day, right? But when I get to the end of the day and I see that and it reminds me to stand up, like, it's actually getting me to change my behavior. If you look at CGMs, people now actually like, the whole CGM movement has brought attention to the fact that sugar is so bad for you. And people are actually, whilst like me and you like probably live in the bubble where it's like, I mean, it's so obvious, like we hear about it all the time, like we know it's bad. But I think a lot of people just don't realize. And it's so easy when you're in the tech bubble to think that You know, this is so obvious, like what's so special about this? But in reality, like giving people the ability to see the actual effects on the human body when, you know, when you eat a bowl of white rice or eat a ton of candy, and seeing the effect on your body and then feeling the effects as well, I think it just does call you to change your behavior, right? Versus without having that information, often people will carry on. They're like, oh, it has, sometimes people just feel fine. I have friends who like still drink like, you know, 3 bottles of Coke a day. And I'm like, that doesn't seem good for you, right? And he's like, I feel fine. He's like, I feel fine, right? I'm pretty sure if he put a CGM on himself, he would see his glucose spike and yeah, he would probably start thinking like, okay, why am I kind of feeling crappy during the day? Like, why when it comes to lunchtime am I feeling pretty bad? Is it because I'm drinking a bottle of Coke, right? And I think I've seen people firsthand change their behaviors by measuring things, and I think that's so important. The same is true for sleep. I see both sides of the argument, but I still sit on I still sit on the fence that I still sit on the side, sorry, where being like measuring these things and being able to bring these things back to a medical professional where they're able to make that decision for you and they're armed with the data and to be able to actually explain to you why this is happening is better than the current system of what we had is like people don't know, and sometimes it, you know, it has really dire consequences and it could have been prevented had you measured and seen change over time and gone and sought the medical opinion of a professional, right?
So I agree with about 50% of what you said, but I would actually agree with one of your points, which is around basically the core thing being like the behavior change. And I would go further actually. So I would say this thesis around information being power and being super helpful and helping people change their behaviors, I can appreciate that there's like a shorter feedback loop. You can see the consequences of your actions today rather than in 20 years. So I totally get that. But I had this experience where I worked with vascular surgeons, and a lot of their day job is basically people come in who are smokers and they have like vascular disease, and ultimately they have to get limbs chopped off because they've died, right? So like they spend a lot of their days in like the operating theater, like chopping people's legs off. And it's like, it's a really like grim thing to happen to someone, right? And then the funniest thing is like a lot of them would then go on smoke breaks, which was so funny, like that, like these people who are seeing like, there's so much information, still smoke. And that really convinced me that like information is like, or data in some ways is like almost useless. And like the most important thing is like the identity change or like the inner psychological work or whatever goes into it that changes it. And that really like started this thesis that like more, maybe it's just trying to be contrarian, but like the more data isn't necessarily that useful.
Hey, again, it's not more data. It's like, I think data with the right software that is incentivizing the correct behavior, does that actually cause change? Like, does it change behaviors in humans? And I think the power of apps and built on top of this data, I think apps like can actually change behavior based off of like wearables data. I think that's what's key. Like, if we agree that, then I think, what do you think on that point specifically, actually? Do you believe that like, software built off of this data has power to change human behavior?
Definitely in a subset of the population, yeah.
Okay, so the question is like, is that subset, are you saying that subset of the population is the wrong subset to go after?
Oh, I didn't think of that. That's an interesting point. Maybe those people who you need to target wouldn't respond, or maybe those people like with the biggest need wouldn't respond as much. But no, I would predict maybe like 20 to 30% of people perhaps will respond to like this data, this gamification, this like shorter feedback loop. That would be my guess.
What we've seen from customers is, you know, by entering wearables data, for example, we have a metabolic health company, one of the largest in the App Store. They focus on like essentially like intermittent fasting and losing weight. People who integrated their wearables data on average, 30%, they lost 30% more weight, right, by integrating the wearables data. So I think for me, that's just like one nugget that shows that like, okay, there is actual value in integrating data from these devices because it can actually incentivize certain behaviors. The question is like, who is actually using these weight apps? Is it people who are in most need of losing weight, right? And that's, I think that's a different question. I think ultimately, we need to find a way, or developers need to find a way, to build applications, or even I think application software that will appeal to the right audience, right? But the fundamental question is, like, does data help incentivize behavior change? I think we can both agree. I think it does.
What's the big moonshot opportunity for Vital? Like, clearly there's something about you being the API for, like, bigger and bigger companies, or everyone in the world who needs it. But are there any, like, rogue opportunities, or any cool things, or any, like, cool vertical or horizontal or something else that I'm not thinking of that you could do?
I think we've got some interesting stuff coming out. Like, I can't mention, but, like, in terms of our roadmap, the general aim of Vital is to get this data in a synthesized fashion back to doctors. And I think what's really cool about Vital is that, unlike other companies, like, we are very much focused on healthcare, and we are very much focused on making sure people can use us in a way where it's consumed almost like a diagnostic as a service, where, you know, if you have any sort of condition, you can use our API to essentially query whether someone is actually exhibiting a certain symptom, or likely to exhibit a specific disease or problem in the future. We've got over 1 million people now connected on our platform, like physically connected in terms of devices on our platform. We have billions of data points, like physically, like we have billions of data points. And I think what's going to be really cool is, like, seeing trends across continuous data and lab data. I think that's going to be really cool. And being able to actually do predictive analytics based on this data, I think that's going to be a real superpower of ours. And then being able to bring those, like, synthesized, I'd say, like, actionable insights to doctors, I think that's going to be key for us. You know, there's a whole movement of, like, lifestyle and functional medicine doctors in the US, and I think that's an interesting space for us, because they are ones who, those types of doctors are typically the ones who are, you know, looking at healthcare or care in general for their patients holistically, versus, like, you know, like, they operate quite differently to a primary care provider in the US. The functional medicine doctor, the lifestyle doctor, will look at things as a whole and try to understand, okay, what is wrong with this patient, versus, like, they are experiencing this symptom and we just need to treat them, right? So from our point of view, that space is really interesting for us. And I think over time, we will be getting that data and the actual insights to the right people, which is, in our eyes, the functional medicine lifestyle doctors, and who will actually be able to do something really interesting with this data.
I think the point around integrating, like, wearable and lab data, and then also maybe, like, some subjective experience of how someone's feeling and, like, the clinical exam, that'll be super interesting, because there's a chicken and egg problem right now where someone comes in with a wearable and they're like, my HRV dipped by 5% on this day, and then my CRP went from 3 to 4. What does that mean? And no one knows, because it's just never something that's been seriously studied, I guess. And it's actually kind of annoying as well, because people come in with, like, an expectation, you don't know what it means, and yep, you don't have any evidence to even tell them or give them any good insight. So I wonder if you'll play a role in that. That would be super interesting.
Yeah. Well, like, what if you could literally say, this is raised and this is why, and these are the steps required, right? So it's almost, like I said, it's like a diagnostic as a service, really, and being able to embed that information to the right people is so important to make sure we get it back to doctors. That's what's most interest, like, really, like, I think is our sort of secret sauce, is the data across multiple modalities, which is, like, the continuous data as well as the lab data, which often, like, companies don't have. Like, they often, like, segregate these two things, and I think to truly do that, you need to have these two things, and then also be armed with, like, eventually, like, maybe the medical history of the patient.
Can you talk about naivety as a superpower?
Yes. So I think one of the most powerful things as a startup founder, and Paul Graham writes about this all the time, is, like, being naive. I think often when you're overloaded with information, for example, and you're thinking about starting a startup, you see all the holes in the problem before you, or, like, your idea before you've even started it. And therefore, you typically, like, talk yourself away from actually starting that idea or that startup. Being naive about a certain industry, but approaching it in an experimental way. At the end of the day, startups are just experiments where you have a certain hypothesis and you're going to test it. but test it with real life, like I'm going to get my product or whatever into the hands of users, and I'm going to see how they react to it. And we're going to learn from that and then adjust my initial hypothesis or test a different hypothesis. And I think that's the having that naivety and just saying, okay, I'm just going to launch it. My idea is probably bad, but who cares? I think, you know, I think it's good. I'm just going to try it and I'm going to learn from it is a superpower versus like, if you knew too much about the industry or too much about specific problems, sometimes it can prevent you from taking action. So that's why like being naive is so important, I think, as a startup founder and treating startups as experiments and being able to, you know, being malleable. Don't be so dogmatic about your, you know, your initial idea that you had. You need to change along the way as you learn more and more about the industry.
So some businesses look really simple and Vital is one that looks really hard. I can't imagine how difficult it is to get hundreds of thousands of wearables, make them all operate with Vital, then include hundreds of different labs and their different measurements and their different standards and put all of that together into like a nice API that then other companies can access like with one click, basically.
Yeah.
How do you start something like Vital? Like what do you do on day one? Because it just seems like such a big beast to tackle. And also the fact that it's not terribly useful for anyone if you're only incorporating like three devices, like you need to be offering a wide range, right? So you can't, on day one, you're probably not that useful, right?
That's true. Like that's what's hard about the product we specifically were building was there was a time where we just had to spend building. And then as soon as we had about five or so devices, we started just approaching companies and saying, okay, can we use this? Now, the thing that was interesting about our strategy is initially, like when we didn't have a lot of devices, we focused on companies who would only want integrations with certain vendors, like or certain devices. For example, there's a great cycling app called Breakaway. They only were really interested in integrating data from two devices at the time. I think it was like Hammerhead and Swift. We said, okay, let's build this for these for this company, and let's see if they like the product, see if they find use in it. And then there were other companies that were focused just on like diabetes and metabolic health conditions. Where, okay, let's integrate with CGMs, BGMs, and then let's try to sell the API and see what they say. I'd say at the start, like Vital was primarily used as with it. We looked at certain verticals and we broke down each like vertical. So okay, how can we build? What are the most important data sources for that vertical? And that's like where we went with it. People often don't realize how hard building like Vital actually is. Once you start like integrating hundreds and hundreds of devices, standardizing data across these devices, it's extremely complex. Like it's very painful. You think like documentation is there on like how they've calculated a certain like HRV. You think there's documentation about like which calculation method they used, whether it's RMSSD. There's SDNN, and it's not like, and you'll have to figure it out, right? or sometimes there's like missing documentation or APIs changing all the time. Like it's really hard. And then when it comes to the lab space as well, what makes it even more hard as you build more integrations with labs is there's a bit more of a human element to working with labs, right? With devices, at the end of the day, you're reading data off them essentially a small machine, and they have a way to interact with those machines. When it comes to labs, it's a lot more difficult. It's more reliant on personal connections with labs. It's a very antiquated industry, so you still have to go visit these labs, see what they're doing, speak to the lab directors. It's kind of a more of a like an older school integration, if I call it that way. And that's what makes it hard, right? So people don't realize that when they're first starting out, we've gone ahead and like done all that hard work. I think Paul PG calls it the schlep. We've done all the schlep of, integrating and building integrations with these different labs and devices. And now people can easily, just use one API to get that information.
So what are the pros and cons of doing an enabler play or an infrastructure play? You're kind of similar to Stripe in the payments processing world. Just take all the hassle of dealing with this payment stuff, and here's one line of code you put into your website and people can have a buy button on their website without all the hassle. But similarly, you're not like the main thing. You're not like the big hot startup, like directly doing the care. You're enabling other startups to do all of that stuff.
I think one of the biggest pros of being like in it, the infrastructure play, is just seeing the amount of companies that use the data or use your API ultimately for different use cases, ones that you would have like never even thought of. I think that's what's like super rewarding. I think the other bit is, from a business point of view, you being an infrastructure, it makes it hard. Like you're such a vital part of a company's process. So if you're picking like a specific data provider, especially health data provider, you're relying on that company staying around for a while, right? Because it's a big investment. You're basing everything on this company. So sales cycles tend to be longer, so that's a negative. But at the end of the day, like once they're actually integrated, you shouldn't really churn that much. So you should really have sort of negative churn because you're such a vital part of the infrastructure, if that makes sense.
What have you learned about getting enterprise sales? Because from a cynical point of view, I mean, you rock up, you're a young guy, Vital's a startup, and then if they do use that in their infrastructure, that's pretty foundational stuff. It's going to be a big problem if you die one day. And statistically, most startups do die. So they're thinking, who's this cowboy? I don't want anything to do with this. I'm guessing a lot of these decision makers might be like significantly older than you as well. Like, I can't imagine going into that room and getting this like huge, significant contract. What have you picked up about how to like gain that trust and get those sales?
You've got to treat enterprise sales the same way you would treat any sort of business problem or any problem you have, even an engineering problem. You have to work out who are the stakeholders in this, right? Like to the point where you look at, the first person that either did the inbound that came to the company, was interested in the company, or whether you've reached out to someone within that company. You basically anchor on who is your champion within the process. So for example, someone might come in, maybe the CTO within that company has reached out, he's kind of interested in the company, and what you'll do is he'll be your champion, right? He'll be the person who's really vouching for your service, and that's because he made the initial reach out, right? So then you have that initial conversation, and then when when it comes to enterprise sales, it's never the CTO. Like the CTO is having the CTO as a champion is great, because then he's ultimately like got the buying power, which is great. Sometimes it's not like that. Sometimes it might be a PM, it might be a developer who's brought you in, and then it's the opposite. You got to work your way up and understand, okay, who's the actual decision maker? Is it the CTO? Is it the PM, etc.? But I'll work with that CTO scenario. So once you've got that champion, what they'll typically do is they'll introduce you to different, essentially like business units or different like teams within the company. They're kind of your cheerleader, but at the same time, like you then need to understand, how do these business units operate? Who do I need to influence in this like specific team or business unit? You also have to understand in a politics sometimes, like why have they brought me in, like, or brought our solution in? What does this mean to that specific team? For example, like if they brought our solution to replace what they currently built in-house, you kind of have to understand, okay, like how is this person feeling, right? That, you know, their previous work is being wiped away and now they're just going to use it off the shelf solution instead, which is, you know, great for the company, saves costs, etc. But sometimes you've got to deal with that inner politics. And I think that's a hard bit of enterprise sales, is really like mapping out who are the stakeholders, understanding like those like inner politics that are happening within the organization, and how your solution being bought influences the company as well, right? And then it's a case of like, you know, if it's an enterprise deal, like actually meeting these people in person, flying out, seeing them. But the hard bit is really just mapping out who the stakeholders are, and understanding like specifically like what are the inner politics, what does this mean like to the company if they were to use a solution, what other problems can we fix for them? So like just being a great listener helps a lot in like enterprise sales, but then also being proactive about understanding like the different dynamics in that organization.
So you went to the Harvard of startups, Y Combinator. What were like the big lessons you picked up from there?
Launching quickly, like YC like hammers it into you, like just launch, like, and that's so important. Like how many people, and this again comes to, it maybe is your superpower. Just launch, like your first idea is never going to be, you know, the best idea. Like it's never going to be the actual like idea that gets you to IPO. It just won't. And it doesn't have to be like a perfect idea. It can just be something that, you know, is a problem that you're fixing for yourself or is something, you know, that you have a strong conviction on. But the most important thing is you get it out there and you test. Get it in the hands of real users, test, iterate. That is the most important lesson, I think, from YC. Launching quickly, speaking to customers, and focusing on product. Everything else, at the end of the day, you can kind of ignore until you've got like that solid foundation where you're getting customers like repeatedly. So I think that's probably the key lesson, just launching quickly, speaking to customers, and making a product that people want. That's their tagline, and it's true.
What about the benefits of like the network and just being in that space? I mean, there's always this belief around you want to be the dumbest person in the room or you want to buy the worst house in the nicest neighborhood. Like that always seems to be the hack. Secondly, also, it seems like a 1,000 IQ move from you to do YC because a startup that does a service that other startups can use going into an incubator with like hundreds of other startups, it's just like they can be your first customers, right? Yeah. So what about like the network / being in the right room aspect and then also just like that 1,000 IQ move of getting your first customers through YC?
Yeah. The network's like one of the best things about YC as well. Like that is one of the best things. The fact that, you know, you have access to a lot of like, you know, startups and then also startups that have, but no longer startups, right? Really huge private companies like Stripe, etc. That, you know, if you wanted to email the CEO and ask them, like, you know, obviously, like, not everyone does this, but, you know, you if you wanted to email the CEO with a certain problem or you think you have a product that's important for that company, you can do that. And often, like, having YC behind you, like, you know, they'll take you seriously. Versus sometimes, you know, if you were just some random, like, emailing, like, you'd often get ignored, I think. And then having access to people who are just one stage ahead of you or, you know, one stage ahead of you where you can actually ask, like, okay, maybe we're at seed level, you're at series A, you know, you can ask all of these, they would have gone through the same problems you went through, and having that resource is so powerful, like it's so helpful. And then the second point is like, yeah, you're right, like YC, because they have such a wide range of startups, you can sell into those startups. But the downsides, I think people always over-glamorize selling to startups. Selling startups is good, and we sell to a lot of startups. They also tend to be, you know, some of the most demanding customers, and also tend to be like low, like you can't charge startups that are there like a lot of money because, you know, they're growing. You want them to see value in their product and hopefully they'll pay for your product, and they will. But at the same time, like you can't charge them like insane amounts, right? And often you're hoping that that startup will eventually succeed and grow to be something that's pretty big.
Last question. Have there been any habits or ways of approaching things that have been helpful for you?
I'm a first generation immigrant. I think I always don't like spending a lot of money. So I artificially have the constraints of, you know, like set by myself is like, okay, we've raised a bunch of venture money, but at the same time, like I don't like to spend a lot of money unless we really need to. And I think keeping the team small until you've truly found product market fit and you truly can't like handle it. Like, you know, you've truly experienced pain and like the ultimate limiting factor on your growth is people. I think that attitude of being that first generation and not spending a lot has helped us. And sometimes it may, you know, it can hinder you because then you're at the same time, you know, like, okay, maybe I don't want to hire more people until we close more deals, right? But at the same time, like you've got to be a bit careful about managing that balance, I think. But ultimately, I think it's not that good. That's probably like the habit that, well, not the habit, just like what's been ingrained to me, like as a first generation immigrant.
Thanks so much for listening. If you've made it this far, you're probably a super fan or you've got nothing better to do. In either case, we'll probably be friends. So you can email me on hi@musty.io. That's hi@musty, musty.io. I lose money on every podcast I make and I'm pretty broke. So if you want to help, there are two things you can do. The first is if there's anyone in your life who you think is equally as nerdy as you, please send them an episode. Send them this one or send them another one you think they might enjoy. Secondly, leave a review on YouTube, on iTunes, on Spotify, wherever you heard this. That helps a lot. Thank you so much and see you next episode.